On the evening of November 7th, 2019, at the Country Bookshelf, a large crowd gathered for a reading by former Oregon Representative Lessa Coyne. His book, Catch and Release, An Oregon Life in Politics, had just been published by University of Oregon Press. He is introduced by the Country Bookshelf's Harry Jenke.
In 1974, at the age of 32, Lessa Coyne became the first Democrat to win a U.S. House seat in Oregon's 1st District. He was one of the post-Watergate reformers who shook up the insulated autocratic Congress and led fights for affordable housing, trickle-up economics, wilderness protection, abortion rights, and the nuclear arms control. In the 1980s, the Oregonian called him the most powerful congressman in Oregon. His career ended in a loss with a bid for the Senate against Bob Packwood in one of the most controversial races in modern Senate history. Ladies and gentlemen, please help me welcome Lessa Coyne.
Well, thank you so much. This is just a splendid turnout. We didn't know what to expect. We were residents of Bozeman for a number of years, and we were hoping to see as many friends as we could, and I'm just delighted, and so is Sue, who's sitting right here, to see so many friends of ours when we were part of your community. It's wonderful to be back in Bozeman. It's wonderful to see these faces that I know so well and for whom I have so much affection. I also have affection for this bookstore. I think the Country Bookshelf is just one of the premier bookstores, independent bookstores, that I've ever encountered. And Harry, we were regular customers when we were here. I just want you to know that. So I'm going to be brief tonight and encourage your questions. But I thought what I'd do is read a couple of passages from the book and then go to your questions and answers about anything that about the process I used to write it, what made me think about writing it, what I left out of the book, why I put some things in and so forth, and anything else that is on your mind. But let me start with a couple of passages, and then we'll take your questions. This is from the preface. This book is not a chronology. Like the Western rivers I love, my storytelling sometimes doubles back and splits a time or two before it resumes its course. Fateful first events launched my story. My journey sculpted it. Parts of the politics I lived were light and funny. Others changed the course of history in the best and worst ways. All parts of that experience show up in these memories. With my 18 years in Congress behind me, I followed Wallace Stegner's advice and returned like a salmonid to the western waters of my birth. There, I turned to fly fishing to replenish my soul. I still thrill to a bent rod and the glitter of a rising form at the end of my line. At that moment of connection, the fish brings me, a visitor, into his realm, and I'm transfixed, because using but a twist of feather and a shard of metal, I have mimicked life from within his world. The hookup is the trout's gift to me, and I honor it with delicate handling. Cradling his body, facing upstream, I let him fill his gills until, revived, he beats a return to nature. The act of catching and releasing squares with life as I've lived it. As a kid growing up fatherless in Central Oregon, a career in America's corridors of power was beyond my comprehension. I caught a life a boy like me wasn't expected to. Yet, when the time came to let go of my work, I like to think I released it reverently for having held it in hand at all. Catching and releasing. Succeeding and letting go. If anything, the ethos works better in life than in fishing. All we can ever do is throw out the best cast we can, that which we can control, and then relax, knowing that what happens next is entirely up to the fish. The following stories describe some of the prizes I've caught and released in my time. Not all releases were entirely voluntary. I recount the times, too, when I snarled my line and what lessons they taught me. Mine is the story of the eldest of two sons, of an abandoned mom who was our sole means of support from the 1940s to the dawn of the 1960s. Despite my modest background, perhaps because of it, I managed to climb up the ladder of national politics. By the time I left public life at the age of 50, a time when many politicians are just getting warmed up, I was a senior member of the U.S. House delegation from Oregon, a Democratic Party whip at large, an official congressional observer to the strategic arms limitation talks with the Soviet Union, and I debated nuclear arms control with officials of both the Reagan administration and Moscow's Supreme Soviet. I also helped double Oregon's wilderness lands, helped lead the charge for women's abortion rights, helped open the way to official relations between the United States and the People's Republic of China, and I helped secure funds for the largest public works project in Oregon history, the Portland metropolitan area's light rail system. I was in my 40s when the Oregonian described me as imaginative and persevering and one of the most influential members of the Pacific Northwest. In some measure, a memoir is a violation of the Fifisher's unspoken code, which disdains any description of one's prowess or bad luck. But I exempt myself here because I wrote these words, these stories, not on Troutwater, but in my writer's den, living in retirement with Sue, my lifelong wedded partner, mother of my children, putter-upper, and my inseparable companion. In telling the stories that follow, I hope to show that to live is to have and have not. Like me, most of us experience both in our journey. However, the best work of one who holds political power is to narrow the gap between having and having not. Such labors distinguish civilization from survival of the fittest. While my political passion still burns strong, I turned in my congressional ID long ago and picked up a fly rod on my native soil. Now I picture myself perched on the soft, grassy bank of a western river, tracking tufts of cottonwood floating against a flawless sky. I'm fascinated by the memories I'm about to tell, sweet and sour alike, as one by one, the rush of water carries them past me one more time. The next story is I included not because it talked about any amendments I introduced in the Congress or tabling somebody's motion, but instead about an experience that I had in the South in the 60s that ended up creating an experience that defined me for the rest of my life. I call it Jim Crow's door. When I was a 19-year-old in the early 60s, 19-year-old Army private in the 1960s, I went on a weekend pass to Nashville, Tennessee. I just wanted a good book and a quiet reprieve from the barking ignorance of my sergeants. One of them was fond of saying, "Aquine, it's ira-goddamn regardless what you think." On my first morning at the YMCA in Nashville, I woke to an odd slapping sound outside my window. A dozen black kids were running in twos down the street, 9 or 10 years old, dressed in Sunday best. Pink chiffon dresses and patent leather shoes, bow ties and blue suits. Two well-dressed young men running with them in front and behind, shooting glances up and down the street. So two well-dressed young black men were in their like 20s, running in front and behind them, shooting glances up and down the street. The scene was adorable, but it seemed odd. It was Saturday, not the Sabbath, Adventist maybe. But why the furtive looks? After breakfast, I took a stroll around the town that they called the Athens of the South. Besides voter registration work with Vanderbilt University students, other visits had been nighttime forays into the honky-tonks of Nashville's Printer's Alley, the dry city's oasis of private clubs. With a one-night membership there, at any of them, you could drink liquor until 3 in the morning. Approaching that afternoon at morning in Church Street, I heard a crowd roar. Probably a parade. But no. No. It was a white mob. When I squeezed up to the front of the police rope, my jaw dropped. The children who had awakened me stood there frozen, wide-eyed, right in front of me, their backs pressed against a brick building, trapped by hundreds of angry, screaming whites at each roped off at each end of the street. You don't know what a racist mob is until you're inside the belly of it. And it seizes your gut and makes your skin burn and drives you dizzy. A pink thunderbird roared through the crowd at one point. In it were 4 young white greasers. When the driver sped up toward the children and jumped the curb, my mind finally caught up with the scene in front of me. They were going to kill the children. The kids jumped clear. The driver slammed the car into reverse, swearing and throwing up a cloud of burnt rubber. From the middle of the street, he slammed it back into first and gunned it again. Once more, the T-Bird flew over the curb. One chaperone pulled the lagging little boy to safety by just inches. The other reached for the car door. The driver, through the open window, pulled out a hunting knife with a blade at least a foot long. "Want some of this, nigga?" he snarled. The chaperone jumped back. Only then did the police arrive. They put the children and their escorts into a paddy wagon and drove off. No one arrested the Thunderbird thugs for their attempted murder. The crowd melted away. I was left on the sidewalk with my 19-year-old knees knocking, trying to comprehend what I had just seen. A few days later, at Fort Campbell, Kentucky, I got off work early and dropped into the Enlisted Man's Club. The radio behind the bar broke in with a statement from the White House. President Kennedy announced that he had nationalized the Alabama National Guard to force Governor George Wallace away from the entrance to the University of Alabama, where he personally, physically blocked the admission of 2 black students. Kennedy's words spoke directly to me. "We are confronted," he said, "primarily with a moral issue. It is as old as the scriptures and as clear as the American Constitution. If an American, because he is dark, cannot eat lunch at a restaurant open to the public, if he cannot send his children to the best public school available, if he cannot vote for the public officials who represent him, if, in short, he cannot enjoy the full and free life which all of us want, then who among us would be content to have the color of his skin changed and stand in his place?" JFK gave voice to all of my feelings from Nashville streets. I have never shaken off the message of Nashville or of Kennedy's summons. It is to fight as a citizen and as a politician against racism, America's original sin, and bigotry in all of its other forms, including bias and hatred of those of a different faith, and Native Americans, and other people of color, and women, and LGBTQ citizens. It seems to me that that message has become especially salient since 2016, that election having belched up, as it did, a new level of racial and anti-Semitic violence and jingoism and xenophobia into the highest level of American politics. We may fail to become the nation that JFK imagined, but I will live my life trying to achieve it. I mentioned that there are 32 chapters in this book. Some of them are very light and some of them are funny. There's a story about how my son Kelly stole George Herbert Walker Bush's tennis shoes in the House members' gym. My son can fill the vice president's shoes. There you go. There's a time when I was in the Army in the South, and I found myself, for reasons you'll have to buy the book to find out, in the middle of the ring with an enraged professional lady wrestler who was enraged at me. It includes also some of my favorite Tip O'Neill stories. Stories about good time Charlie Wilson of Charlie Wilson's War. The Defense Secretary, Caspar Strangelove. Newt Gingrich. And a host of other characters. Some cads, some just characters. Including Bill Hungate of Missouri, who in his farewell speech to his colleagues told them, "May the future bring all of the best to you, your family, and your friends. And may your mom never find out where you work." Okay, now it's your turn. Anyone have questions? Frankie.
So in public office, and as your stories already indicate, you often feel or realize soon afterward that you're a part of history, you're part of moving something in a good direction, and that it's going to have an impact long into the future. And sometimes you feel that that's happening and then it fails. Could you describe one of those experiences where you felt you were on the right track moving us forward and
we're not? Yes. Yeah, I will. And I want to tie that in with something else I've heard also from at other readings. And that is this idea that we've sort of fallen into without being as civically sophisticated as we could be. And that is that once something is enacted, it's like written in stone. Well, unfortunately, it's not written in stone. And those things we have to fight for, we have to keep fighting for. I remember standing with Sue at night in the Jefferson Memorial and reading the words of Jefferson etched on the inside of on the ceiling. They were, "I declare eternal hostility to all forms of tyranny over the mind of man." And the thing is, the thing that that captures is that we have to continue the fight. This is a process. Democracy is never done. And the one event that I'm thinking of was in the legislature in Oregon when I was House Majority Leader in my second term. And we passed, with Governor Tom McCall's strong support, we passed a Consumer Protection Act for subdivision sales that were go, 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 hype, hype, hype. And many of them very unscrupulous. And so we, working with his staff and mine, passed through the legislature with overwhelming numbers a Consumer Protection Act that allowed someone who purchased something that promised pine trees and rivers and so forth, or usually these are out-of-state buyers, only to find out that there was sagebrush and dust, they would have a three-day period to get out of the deal. Well, the secondary housing market went nuts. Because you see, what those bankers who wrote mortgages did was they would bundle them and sell them into the secondary market. But if you have a bad mortgage inside a bundle like this, then it's tainted, it's poisoned. So people stopped, the secondary market stopped buying any packaged mortgages from Oregon. Well, all hell broke loose. I can remember even now the members of the Oregon Home Builders Association, who later became my allies, in the galleries wearing red hats. They didn't say MAGA, but they said repeal. And the legislature was called back into session for a one-day special session, and it was repealed. No one gave any thought to the fact that a mortgage originator could hold that mortgage for 3 days before putting it into a bundle and sending it up to the secondary market. So Governor Tom McCall and I had passed a landmark piece of legislation, just seismic in its ability to protect the Oregonians. And in one day, under pressure, it was taken away. But that's what you have to do when you're in politics. You have to catch, and then you have to learn how to release your losses, and then move on to the next time. A great question. Yes, Chris.
Our country's history, certainly in our lifetimes, have had many instances of conflict, and we're in one now, of course, but in your experience, what made you a person who could navigate conflict and turn it into positive things, and what are those pieces?
To answer your question, I believe that compromise is one of the high arts of politics. And a lot of people think that's a dirty word. You don't hear people going around saying, oh, God, this is just great. We compromised. No, you know, I had a businessman in Portland turn to me at a dinner party and say, Les, why is it that we send all of you good people back to Washington and you're going to do great things, but then you stoop to compromise? And I'm saying in my mind, because we're not a dictatorship, we're a democracy. Yeah, compromise is to democracy what oxygen is to you and me. And without it, neither can survive. And so what I always try to do is to connect the dots. You try to find some aspect of the position that the person holds who's against you and see what can connect with that in the position you hold. It was never more obvious to me than when I was in the conference committee on the interior appropriations bill and Department of Interior and then related agencies. The senators had accepted an amendment from that genius from North Carolina, Jesse Helms, that cut off all federal funds for the National Endowment for the Arts because it displayed sexual organs in a patently offensive way. Well, not wanting to be accused of being lewd, they fought for that in the conference. We on the House side did not have that provision. In fact, we abhorred it. We thought Jesse Helms was a demagogue. In fact, we were convinced he was a demagogue. But on our side, we had something that they violently objected to, the senators. And that was to finally increase grazing fees on the public range, because for too long, those fees have been below market prices. And this had been a fight that had been going on for a long, long time, way below market prices. So here we were. And you have in these conference committees, you can have as many as 1,000 issues. And what you do is you go through and you solve the ones you can, and you go all the way down to the bottom. And then you come back and you start over again, and it's like a rake. And then you come back. And in this particular conference, it came down to two things. Jesse Helms's abolishment, in fact, of the National Endowment for the Arts and grazing fees. And for 4 days, anger and emotion on both sides just continued. And we were stuck in this warm, small room. And I thought we're going to die there, to tell you the truth. And finally, I just looked across at these scowling faces, Senate faces across the table from us. And I could almost smell cow dung on their boots. And without consulting anyone, I said, Mr. Chairman, I move that the House drop its insistence on higher grazing fees if the Senate will drop its ban on funding of the National Endowment for the Arts. Silence. And then Senator James McClure of Idaho said, Congressman O'Coin, every man has his price, and you've just met mine. And it passed and got signed into law. And what you have to do is look for those pieces, those commonalities. They're not the full loaf. In the case of grazing fees, we could come back later and deal with that. But if you abolish the National Endowment for the Arts, there's very little hope that you're going to come back with that. But final part of the story, I've answered your question, but you need to know that was the end of the conference. It had gone on for almost a week, and everybody was exhausted. We walk out into the hallway, and I was one of the first ones out, and the arts advocates and the National Cattlemen's Association were all out there virtually dancing in the corridor, laughing and having a good time, and they called the amendment Corn for Porn. And so among my many accomplishments is that I was the author of Corn for Porn. But that's a great question, though. And you know, we need to look for those things. Today, more than ever, we are polarized. We all know that. But there have to be people who will look for some one thing that you can connect with. And it may be very, very small. But if you connect and make it happen, then if you've got some success on both sides, and maybe you go back and you get something bigger the next time. John Kasich from Ohio, former governor, former House member, former candidate for president, very conservative. He and I used to debate weapons on the floor, and we were never like, you know, this confrontation now. This was in a better day. But I can remember on the MX missile, we would debate back and forth and throw best arguments back and forth, and yielding to each other, and finally we'd be done. And John would come over to me and say, "Les, you're forgetting A, B, C." And I'd say, "Oh, but John, you're forgetting X, Y, Z." And he would say, "I'll see you tomorrow." And he'd come back with fresh arguments. And we'd go through this. And we ended up with respect for each other. And it turned out that John Kasich actually compromised with Ron Dellums, the first black chairman of the Armed Services Committee and a very, very powerful liberal, on killing the B-2 bomber because it was excessive, it didn't have a mission, it was excessively expensive, and it was duplicative of everything else we in our arsenal. And they joined together. It was a Dellums-Kasich amendment. But it started with small agreements, and then trust built. And I'd like to see more people doing that kind of thing today. Yes, I think I know you. I think this is Morgan Lee. I think that she may... You have a remarkable resemblance to my eldest granddaughter.
Can't imagine why.
Stand up and ask.
Okay. Yeah, so just kind of one thing that I've noticed in the zeitgeist of this time now is a rise in censorship and fake news. And this is a really broad question, but I wondered, like, what your thoughts on are about that, the dangers of that.
I'm very, the question is the rise of censorship or by calling news fake news. I think that's an easy way to discredit what could be very truthful news. And my preference would be to have leaders who will counter the alleged fake news with facts of their own that show that the assertion is fake or is not accurate. Up here on the wall here, there's a fabulous saying. I was talking to Harry, who is managing the event here at the Country Bookshelf tonight. It just struck me. And it says, "Censorship is to art as lynching is to justice." You could almost say censorship is to politics what lynching is to justice. And so I think it's really up to us to insist on better behavior. And now another problem, though, for all of us, is that who do you trust? What media sources do you trust? I have people who I'm acquainted with who I'll say, "I read in the New York Times." The New York Times, that left-wing rag. Well, it's not a left-wing rag, but he thinks so. Or somebody will talk about something on the other side. Every one of us, especially young people that haven't had no experience with this atomization of journalism, it's atomized. You know, we used to have three TV channels and we would gather around the fire. But now we have just so many of them, and we can dial in what we want to hear and we can dial out what we don't want to hear. And that's a real challenge for governance. How do you govern when you can't have everybody listening to the same quote-unquote facts? I think it's incumbent on all of us not just to vote. I'm going to get on that in a second. In fact, I'll get onto it right now. We are 29th among world democracies in terms of voting age citizens who actually turn out and vote. 29th. We are the cradle of modern democracy, and we're 29th. I'll tell you, as bad as the mess is in Washington, and I agree with you that we have a mess, but those who did not vote have ownership over it, just as much as those of us who tried but failed to do whatever it was we wanted to do. Then comes in the question of, well, what are your sources of news? The other part of citizenship today, and it's complicated, because the world is more complicated. We don't just have three TV channels. We have podcasts. We have the social media. We have all of these sources. We have to be diligent in trying to find two or three sources that come at facts slightly differently so that you can weigh the pros and cons. NPR is one I would absolutely recommend. I listen to it, Sue and I, every day. I do believe that the New York Times, GASP, is not a left-wing rag. I also subscribe to The Economist magazine, a conservative magazine in London, and you get a kind of a foreign perspective of facts that are going on in the United States. So mix it up. Now, is that hard? Yeah, and it's getting harder because the income distribution in the country is getting severe. Those of us Americans who work for a living are having to work harder to get ahead. So how do you find the time to do all of this stuff that's part of citizenship? Well, how can you afford not to? Because I'll tell you, here's my view. This coming election is not just about electing some candidate who's going to occupy the White House. I think it may very well be an election about the future of our democracy. That's how important it is. Hope I answered your questions, Morgan.
Over your years in Washington and from both sides of the aisle, whom did you admire most and why?
Great question. There were so many. Even now, there are quiet heroes that we just don't hear about. But in my day, I'd have to include in the number, and this spans a lot of years, Barbara Jordan. That woman knew the Constitution and she knew that the Constitution wasn't just a piece of paper. She understood what a lot of us are forgetting, which is it's only a piece of paper if we don't abide by and believe in and honor the principles of it. If we ignore them by having an institution that doesn't comply with a subpoena, it's a piece of paper. So and like that. So Barbara Jordan was amazing. Tip O'Neill was another great one. One quick story about Tip. I got to tell you a Tip story. Come on. Tip was just a wonderful man. 6'3", wide, no, high, maybe 300 pounds, smart as hell, but not modern. And one day, I was very close to Tip. One day, Barney Frank came into his office, his ceremonial office, off the House floor. And Barney had decided he was going to reveal his sexual orientation. And Tip, a devout Catholic, was not fazed on a religious basis. All he cared about was, Barney, are you going to be okay politically? Can you handle this? And Barney assured him that he could. He said he had some polls, it's going to be closer. But he assured him, and he said, but on top of that, this is who I am, Tip, and I've got to be who I am. So Tip and he had a long conversation, as Tip tells me. And then Barney leaves, and at length, Tip walks out of onto the House floor. And who should he run into first? But Pat Schroeder, the liberal congresswoman from Colorado. And Tip grabs her arm and says, Pat, you're not going to believe this about Barney. And she said, what? He says, Barney's coming out of the room. Close, pretty close. There's a closet in most rooms. Yes, good way to go, Tip. Once we were I was having breakfast in the members' dining room with my son Kelly and my daughter Stacy, Morgan's mother. They were young, and Tip comes in with his entourage for breakfast, and he sees us almost empty. He sees us over there, and he just could not stop but come over and talk to us. And he looked at Kelly, who was close to him, and he kind of tousled his hair, and he said, "Well, what would be your name, young lad?" And Kelly said, well, Kelly, sir, Kelly O'Coin. And he used that O apostrophe pronunciation on O'Coin that I use. Well, the Kelly and the O apostrophe rang some kind of a bell in the back of the speaker's mind, and he said, "Ah, a lad from the old sod. So good to meet you." And I'd worked with Tip for at least 6 years. And I said, and I knew I had to say something. I said, "Tip, we're Acadian French, Tip. A-U-C-O-I-N. And Tip kind of smiled. I never saw him blush, but he kind of smiled and he turned and he started shuffling away. And he, over his shoulder, he said, "Well, you guys are both good enough looking to be Irish." John Anderson, the Republican congressman from Illinois, ran for president on an independent ticket in 1980. One of the brightest people I ever saw, and never once did I think that he did a thing, even though he did a thing against that wasn't in his mind for the country of party, and though we disagreed a lot. Louis Stokes of Ohio, a major member of the Congressional Black Caucus, he had the tough duty of being chairman of the Ethics Committee. See how hard it is to get the word ethics out of a politician? It's just I've been out for 26 years and it's still tough. I don't know. So those are a few. Nancy Pelosi. But Ron Dellums. Ron Dellums, and I won't take any more time than just mentioning those two. I love both of them. And Ron passed away a year ago. Fortunately, we were able to have dinner with Sue and me, with him and Cynthia, a couple of months before his death. I love him, and I cried like a baby when he passed away. Ron Dellums, when he first came to Congress 2 years before I did, the chairman of the Armed Services Committee was a Southern, Eddie Hebert, Louisiana, and a segregationist. And he wouldn't give Ron Dellums a chair. Ron had to sit on a little stool at the end of the dais. And from that beginning, Ron slowly worked forward and obviously moved into chairs. But he became, as I said earlier, the chairman, the first black chairman, one of few chairmen of the Armed Services Committee, and was regarded by Republicans and Democrats alike as one of the fairest chairmen they had ever seen. And I have to say this to you, I have never been one who can give a speech without looking at some notes. I don't like to read a speech, but I have to have some notes. I don't know how many times I heard Ron Dellums speak on the floor. He was one of the most eloquent orators I ever saw and always spoke the truth. Whether it was popular or not, he pulled no punches. And he never once looked at a scrap of paper. Not once. He was so good that when he took the floor, my chief of staff told me that the word would get out in my staff, "Mr. Dellums is speaking." And everybody would stop what they're doing and go in front of the closed circuit monitor and watch Dellums speak. He was unbelievable. And we need more like that. So I hope those are a few good examples. Yeah. Eddie.
First comment, then a question. So first of all, I'm not completely through the book, but almost through the book, and I just love the way you've integrated your life and your work as a representative. I just think it's extraordinary, and the way that you took in information and in certain instances changed your perspective or became more committed, you know, gun control, conservation. I hope that can still happen today. But I guess my question is your perspectives on watching Nancy Pelosi, since you brought her up, navigate what's happening now and how much power she actually can wield in this situation.
Questions about Nancy Pelosi, how much power she can wield in a situation like this. And I guess another part of your question, Maddie, is what else about her is good or bad? What is her come from? Is it virtuous or not? I am a personal friend of Nancy Pelosi's. She came to Congress after I did. I think she's suffering nationally in this contest between the two parties what Tip O'Neill suffered, and that is to be caricaturized and villainized by the opposition party. There were caricatures of Tip that made him look like a rhinoceros, and they would vilify him. And the same thing's happening with Nancy. You would think that she was a witch when you look at some of these things. I'm here to tell you that she is a lady, a refined, sensitive lady. She also was born in Baltimore and grew up in Democratic politics. Her father was very powerful, and she knows politics. And I think the President of the United States, our current President of the United States, underestimated her, and I think she's given him all he can handle and more. She has seldom lost the almost universal support of her party as a leader. You compare that to Speaker Boehner a few years ago, when he couldn't keep his own party together. No one knew where the center was in those days. Nancy is different. She knows either by persuasion or by driving fear in the hearts of some people, she knows how to put together a unified party. I think there's no one more capable and has a better understanding of the constitutional consequences of the moment we're in than Nancy does. I know there are those here that will disagree with me, but that's my point of view, and it's an informed point of view. I've known her since she arrived as a freshman in the House of Representatives. Yes, the question is about Portland's mass transit system, and I did have a major role in getting that through along with Senator Mark Hatfield, and he's somebody I would also add as a respectable person I met with and worked with. He was the chairman of the Appropriations Committee in the Senate when I was a senior member of the House Appropriations Committee.
I think in the introduction was mentioned that you were responsible for getting funding for the Portland MAX, and I wonder now that when you look at it now, did the way it developed conform to the vision you had at the time when you sought funding it? And I say this as an ex-Seattleite who's always admired Portland's transit system versus what we had.
Frankly, the vision that we had has been overtaken in some ways by the rapid population growth that has befallen Portland. But I will say that without extensive light rail and system, the highways, which are now often like parking lots at rush hour, would be absolutely impossible otherwise without that transit system in place. That was one of my biggest shocks when Sue and I left Bozeman and went back to Portland. And we went back to Portland. We came to Bozeman because we wanted to watch the young lady who stood up and asked me the question, my eldest granddaughter, who was in preschool at the time, and her sister was in preschool. We came out here, so having done some math, taking their age and thinking about visiting here twice and then multiplying that by what our life expectancy was, and not liking the mathematical results. So that's why we were here, and that's why we went back. But I was stunned to see how much Portland has changed. The cars and the population has just really jammed the cars into these streets. And I can only say it'd be worse without it. Portland's going to have to make some very, very important decisions. I'm seeing city leaders that are, and I won't go into detail because this is Bozeman and you probably could care less, but they're going to have to make some decisions about doing some alternative things because we can't keep doing what they've done in the last 20 years when we've been gone. I'm surprised at the city that I see right now. I can't, with all these cars making these freeway ramps look like parking lots at 3 o'clock in the afternoon from people driving home. They're building actually a series of high-rise condos, one of which is 35 stories high and is going to serve, I think, something like 400 families. And they're all going to have cars. Well, they may ride MAX, you know, light rail, but they're going to be in cars. To answer your question, there's a disappointment there. But thank God it's in place because it'd be ever so much worse. Other questions? Come on. Yes.
Talk a little bit about the process of writing the book and how you decided to put in what you put in and why you chose the memoir as a method of expression.
I wrote the book because I thought there needed to be, the literary world, the artistic world needed a something that would be the basis of the next Broadway musical. No. I tried writing fiction, and I'm no good at it. I have a manuscript on my shelf in my somewhere in my house. I say it was stillborn, and so I can't write fiction. But I've been a journalist almost all my life, and my journalistic experience grew into op-eds, which then grew into essays. And then, you know, kind of literary essays. And then I've lived a very eventful life. Morgan's father, Peter Lee, who's sitting right next to her, was asking me years ago, for God's sake, Les, you know, you can write. Not everybody can write. At least write a memoir that for the girls. And so that was one piece of it. And then I started thinking about all the mischief I had created in my life and some very interesting stories. It's been an eventful life. I sprung a Jewish refusenik family out of the Soviet Union after performing surreptitious covert acts, messages inside the halls of the Kremlin. And my daughter took an envelope with a letter to a high-ranking Soviet diplomat who had been returned to the Soviet Union and slipped it to him surreptitiously, and 2 months later they were released. I was the first congressman to be able to take a delegation, home state delegation, any delegation, to the People's Republic of China in February of 1979. If you think about your history, that was 130 days after the relations were formed. Unbelievable experiences. There were stories that I wanted the kids to know, and I started thinking, well, there's stuff here that's worthwhile for Oregonians to know. Did they know that in the controversial wars and civil wars in Central America, that the Salvadoran army sponsored death squads that not only did violence to their own people, but actually sent a known death squad member to my colleague George Miller's congressional district in the San Francisco Bay Area to scope out places where he frequented. That actually happened. We interviewed George and me and others who made those trips, the fascists who were there. And it drove me crazy that who were running things, and we were on the wrong side. We were, anyway, It just annoyed me that all a dictator had to say, a right-wing dictator had to say, is, I'm not a communist. And that seemed to be good enough for the people in Washington, D.C. And I was determined to fight back. So these, you know, Central America and the Soviet Union and China and places like that, and all of these memories, I thought that they were unique enough to put into a book, and so far people are responding, and I hope they continue to respond.
Maybe it's going to be like the next Jack Ryan series.
There you go. Yeah. Make it a Jack Ryan series and make it a Broadway musical. Now that's going to be a winning ticket. Any other questions?
We've had a chance to share just informally over the years about your experiences with the START Treaty, and we're in the midst of the unraveling.
Yes.
And so could you comment about what putting one of those treaties together really entails, and then, in your view, what's going on today, the rest of it?
You've raised one of the most disturbing questions that we face, and there's so many things going on in the world that the media is not giving this the coverage it should. There is no nuclear arms control agreement left between the United States and the Soviet Union. I was an official, one of four congressional observers to the arms talks, and it was give and take. The Soviets' arsenal was always mostly land-based. ours was sea-based. And we always insisted that most of the cuts be land-based. Well, you know how that went over in Moscow. Easy for you to say, U.S. You got most of yours at sea. And so it's back and forth. And it took years, all through Carter's years. And then Reagan's years. He at least got the Reagan, at least, who came in thinking we could. I talked about Caspar Strangelove. That was his defense secretary. He came in at the beginning of his term proposing that bomb shelters. And the first question I asked, because Caspar Strangelove in the Defense Appropriations Committee, he testified, he said, our strategic doctrine is to fight a global nuclear war and survive. And I said, Mr. Secretary, how in the world do you think we survive a global thermal nuclear war? And I'll never forget his response. Well, you don't think we should lose, do you? That was the level that the Reagan team came in with. But ultimately, Reagan negotiated the elimination of all theater nuclear weapons, the INF Treaty, which was a real start. And he made some headway on the intercontinental ballistic missiles. And then George Bush, his successor, got START passed. And then Obama got START II passed. And what Trump has done is to pull out of every single one of those, and Putin has reciprocated by the same thing, so we have none. And what we have now instead of these restraints, which were fully verifiable, we had a verification regime on both sides that would go against any cheating. Absent those treaties, we have first strike weapons in both arsenals. And I put to you this question. If you have two scorpions in a bottle and they think that they're in danger, what's going to happen? Because they are just like the Soviet Union and the United States now, because there's nothing but them and their weapons. The only defense is to strike before you think you're going to be struck. And we're back to square one. Our only defense is to bomb the Dickens out of, but they'll release theirs, and that'll be a Pyrrhic victory. I'm just praying that out of the election of 2020, we'll have some semblance of rationality brought back into this. This was one of the things I spent a good part of my life in the Congress to try to achieve. I authored the amendment that banned anti-satellite weapons. If neither side had anti-satellite weapons, that would mean that our early detection satellites would be safe, and you could detect cheating on the other side. But if we build an anti-satellite weapon and they build an anti-satellite weapon, what you could use is you could use them to blind the opponent and then launch an ICBM attack. So we have a lot at stake here. We have the climate itself. We have the Earth itself at stake. We have our form of government at stake. We have the survival of the human race at stake. And if we're going to sit around and be 29th in the world in terms of voting, then I just am at a loss. I have no words. We've got to know the urgency that we're faced with. And it's all of that and more. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
You have just heard a reading by former Oregon Representative Les O'Coyne, held at the Country Bookshelf on the evening of November 7th, 2019. His book, Catch and Release, An Oregon Life in Politics, had just been published by University of Oregon Press. This has been a Beyond the Deep End production, recorded and produced by Joy LeClaire for listener-supported Gallatin Valley Community Radio, KGVM Bozeman.